This year, on February the 24th, Russian troops invaded Ukraine. We watched and listened in disbelief as the largest European war since 1945 began.
For weeks, as Russian troops have massed on Ukraine's border, President Putin's intentions have been opaque.
Уважаемые граждане России, дорогие друзья.
Dear citizens of Russia, dear friends, the topic of my speech is the events in Ukraine and why it is so important for us, for Russia.
Ukraine is a nation at war tonight after Russia launched a full-scale invasion of the former Soviet state. Russian President Vladimir Putin ignored last-minute pleas for diplomacy and launched his major military assault on several Ukrainian cities.
In the battle for Ukraine, Kyiv became the latest front line. The country's capital woken by explosions just before dawn. The country's leader claimed he was the target and issued this dire warning.
This is the sound of a new Iron Curtain, which has come down and is closing Russia off from the civilized world.
The words there of Ukraine's President Zelensky. Now 10 months on, what do we understand about Vladimir Putin's motivations and where will he take the conflict in 2023? To analyse the roots of this war and understand what is driving Putin, we're joined this morning by Professor Mark Ederle. He's a historian of the Soviet Union and Deputy Dean in the Faculty of Arts at the University of Melbourne. And Mark Galeotti, he's the author of Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine, published last month, and he's the honorary professor at the University College London School of Slavonic and East European Studies. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Hello.
Mark Galeotti, as the title of your new book shows us, this is far from Putin's first war. Let's go back to February. Were you surprised when Russian troops went into Ukraine?
I think in fairness, on the Monday beforehand, there had been this televised meeting of Putin's Security Council, which was a deeply surreal and disturbing affair. I think at that point, I was thinking, oh dear, something's happening. But up to that point, I'll be honest, I had thought it was no more than 30 to 40% likely, for the simple reason that it didn't make sense. Of course, what we didn't know is that what didn't make sense to the outside world may well have made sense to Putin. And that was the key thing. It was a difference in perspectives.
Mark, what was your impression?
Well, all the information we had running up to the actual invasion looked as if they were to invade. But like the other Mark, I had sort of convinced myself that it can't happen because it was such a stupid idea, clearly. It was clear that they would get into serious trouble going into Ukraine and that Ukrainians would fight for their country. But there was all evidence that they are about to go in. They brought blood reserves to the front line. It didn't look like a bluff, but I had managed to convince myself about 24 hours before the invasion that it wouldn't happen. Like Mark, I mean, there was a kind of sense like, why would you do that? We're still dealing with the fallout of that, I think.
We are. Look, Mark Galeotti, that obviously, you know, we didn't really, there weren't many people who were right about lots of things. But one thing that struck me is that there was a view that it would happen all very quickly and that Kyiv would fall. And it didn't. Why was there such a big underestimation of the fight back from Ukraine?
Yeah, it is very striking. Particularly, it's actually, ironically enough, those people who were most bullish that Putin would invade were also the ones who were telling us that exactly 2 weeks and it'll all be over. I think that, there's a variety of reasons. I think, yes, people did underestimate the Ukrainians, not just their determination to fight, but also, look, they'd spent basically 8 years preparing for this war. And they had been thinking very carefully and very effectively about what to do. And again, I think people really hadn't taken that on board. But perhaps most importantly of all, I think people were neglecting the degree to which Ukraine had another secret weapon, and that was Vladimir Putin himself. The Russian military has a whole approach to fighting wars that is meant to maximize its strengths and minimize its weaknesses. And Putin, frankly, ignored all that. He didn't rely on his generals to plan and manage his war. He ran this invasion as if it was some kind of spook special operation, like the seizure of Crimea back in 2014, rather than actually a proper war. Had the Russians actually invaded the way their army trains, prepares, and is geared for fighting, well, then things might have been different. But I think, again, as well as underestimating Putin's capacity to convince himself of things that aren't true, in particular that the Ukrainians wouldn't resist, we also underestimated just how disruptive it is to have a, well, let's be honest, a dictator who has basically no military experience, and yet who decides that he himself is going to dictate how the invasion will happen.
Mm. Mark, what do you believe is driving Putin? Does he still feel resentment about the breakup of the Soviet Union? Is this his aim, to try and rebuild the former USSR? Is that really something he thinks he can do?
Yes, resentment. I mean, resentment is a very big thing, I think, in Putin's mental and emotional world. I don't think it's a USSR he wants to rebuild. I mean, very few people in that leadership surely want a communist state. What he wants to rebuild is the Russian Empire. So he this is a funny thing for a historian to say, right? That studying history might be a toxic activity, but he has, over the last 2 years where he was in isolation, I mean, he's been reading and writing history for a very long time. This is how I sort of became a Putin watcher on the side, because I was following his kind of historical pronouncements. And he, in the last 2 years, he has been locked away in COVID isolation and steaming in his own juices and reading history and writing history. And a kind of imperial Russian history, where he imagines himself as some kind of latter-day Vladimir the Great who will rebuild the Russian Empire. And we should also understand that he turned 69 last year and turned 70 this year. So he is an aging macho man who is trying to have a legacy. So there is some very personal things going on in this war. And the Security Council meeting Mark referred to really showed that this is Putin's. I mean, this was Putin's idea, and Putin had the whip hand, and he whipped the others into shape.
So given what you just said, is there any chance of him retreating or recalibrating, or is this just going to go on and on based on the picture you just painted?
Quite possibly, if the regime remains stable internally, this might go on for a while. But of course, it's not Putin's decision to retreat. It's the Ukrainian army who make them retreat. So, waiting for Putin to end this might not work, although he has now signaled that he's ready for negotiations under his terms, which are essentially not acceptable to Ukrainians at this point.
Mark Galeotti, is it significant that he's put that signal out, even if the terms are clearly not to be met or not going to be met by the US and allies? But is it significant that he's even going there?
I think it's more optics than anything else. Look, the Russians have been saying this all along. Of course, we're happy to talk with no preconditions, because in some ways they were trying to paint the Ukrainians into a corner in which they would say, we will talk if you're willing to withdraw your forces from our territory. And then they could say, you see, it's the Ukrainians who are actually causing the problems. We're in a situation where basically I think Putin has acknowledged that he's not going to win a war on the battlefield. His best chance is to drag things out as long as he possibly can, in the hope that in due course, the Ukrainians may lose the will and capacity to resist. That's highly unlikely. And more likely it is that Ukraine fatigue begins to basically undermine the West's willingness to continue to underwrite Ukraine to the phenomenal level that it is doing now. So in some ways, what he's trying to do is open wedge issues between Ukraine and the West and within the West. So by trying to sound reasonable, He's hoping that that helps his cause. But to be honest, at the present moment, there is no point in any kind of conversation because the two sides are just so far apart. Mm. The Ukrainians, frankly, think that they're on a roll, and Putin knows he has to hedge for time.
Mike Galeotti, just staying with you. President Putin has repeatedly blamed Mikhail Gorbachev, who died in August this year, for failing to secure written commitments from the West that would rule out NATO's expansion eastward. The issue really has marred Russian relations with the West for decades. How do you respond to the theory that the war started because Ukraine was seeking NATO membership?
I think that's actually quite a strong element, though we have to remember that the real conflict, you know, if we go back to 2014, 2013, was actually because of a closer relationship with the European Union. But I think, look, let's be honest about this. Yes, in Putin's head, NATO is an aggressive and indeed conspiratorial alliance, trying to undermine his regime, trying to sort of hem Russia in. In practice, when NATO said that someday Ukraine will be a member, it's not actually as if they had any belief in that. It was just, if to be perfectly honest, they were just fobbing Kyiv off. No one really wanted Ukraine as a member. The trouble is, this was a kind of compromise that pleased no one. It basically made the Ukrainians feel more confident. It made the Russians feel more embattled. This is really a failure of communication and politics, rather than actually that we can blame NATO, because NATO's eastward expansion was because countries wanted to join, not because NATO sort of encroached upon them.
Mark, what's your view on that?
Well, I'm in furious agreement with my colleague here. There was no written commitment to not expand NATO into the east. There were oral communications to that extent, and the Americans and other part of NATO did change their mind eventually under the influence of East European countries who, for very good historical reasons, wanted to be among the strongest alliance they could have against potential Russian aggression. In 2008, there was moment where Ukraine could have been put on a path towards NATO membership, and that failed because NATO members were not united on this. In particular, Germany had taken the Russian line that this was a dangerous escalation, and the result was this kind of somewhat foul compromise, which said, yeah, the door is open, but at the moment we won't let you in. And NATO membership is one of the aspirations now, which is written into the constitution of Ukraine. And all of that does worry the Putin regime, which is deeply conspiratorial, thinks of the world as being, you know, driven by people who hate them, and frankly have a kind of have not come to terms with the fact that the empire is over and want to rebuild it.
Just in the cup, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but just final thoughts from you, Mark Galeotti, a final thought. Many strategists, military experts, historians like yourselves have thought long and hard about how this conflict might end. How do you see it?
Oh, heavens, it's a conflict that really has defied prediction. I think this is going to drag on. I mean, hopefully by the end of next year, it'll be over. The big question is whether or not Ukraine will have regained all its territory, or whether or not Crimea will be the subject of some kind of a deal. But essentially, I think the Ukrainians are likely to win in the long haul.
Mark?
Yeah, I mean, two things. One, I basically agree. And two, I'm a historian, so I'm not really in charge of the future.
Don't we learn about the future from history? That's what I was told.
Yes, we learn that we can't predict the future. We can predict the past extremely precisely, but the future is open. But yes, this might go on for a while unless there is some kind of thing going on in Moscow itself, which doesn't seem very likely, but, you know, one never knows. But this will probably be decided on the battlefield, it looks.
Thank you to the two Marks. Really appreciate your time. Professor Mark Adeli is a historian of the Soviet Union and Deputy Dean of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Melbourne. Mark Galeotti is Honorary Professor at University College London, and his new book, Putin's Wars, From Chechnya to Ukraine, is out now.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.
Me again, podcasters. I hope you're enjoying our coverage of international affairs on RN Brekkie. And if you're looking for more stories that put world events into context, then look for Between the Lines on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.